Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
A beautiful question.
That's a great question.
Lauren.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, and this is the first half of my conversation with journalist Amy Gammerman, author of The Crazies, The Cattleman, The Wind Prospector, and A War Out West, a sprawling, deep-historied narrative of a land dispute in the shadow of Montana's Crazy Mountains. The Crazies tells the story of a proposed wind farm that triggers a 21st-century range war between a struggling cattle rancher and some of the wealthiest people in America. This is a book of compelling characters, and I'll let Amy introduce those characters here in a minute. Family and cultural histories, beautiful landscapes, harsh weather, extractive impulses, and so much more. Amy, thank you so much for joining me to talk about The Crazies. Welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you, Lauren. It's just a pleasure to be here.
Before we dig into The Crazies, before we take our conversation to Big Timber and to the Crazy Mountains in South Central Montana, I want to ask you about you. Because we're here to talk about land and place, I'm curious, what are your landscapes of origin, and do they differ from your chosen landscapes, the landscapes that you're occupying now?
My landscape of origin is a very tame one. It's suburban. I was born in New York City, but I can't even claim that fantastic urban landscape as my own because from the time I was a very young child, my family was living in one suburban neighborhood or another. And so that's the landscape I was given. The Western landscape is very exotic to me. It's alien. And I don't know that it is my chosen landscape. I think I am very much an alien when I am within it, if that makes sense. But I just find it completely compelling, and I think I'm able to understand a bit about why it evokes such strong emotions in the people who do live there, because I am coming from such a different place.
So you were born in New York.
Yes.
And where do you live now? Is it in Connecticut? Mm-hmm. Is that where you live now?
Yes. I was born in New York and I now live in Connecticut, or I would say tends more toward rural. We live in an old farmhouse on, what used to be a farm, as much of Connecticut was. And we're quite near the coastline. So we're sort of between almost in the smack dab in the middle between New York City and Boston.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, this is a vastly different landscape than the landscape you're writing about in The Crazies.
Yes.
How did you come to this story then? If this is not a place you're familiar with, where did this story come from? What drew you to it in the way that you were compelled to write a 400-page book about it?
Well, I write for the Wall Street Journal, and since about 2012, I've written for the journal's personal real estate section, which is called Mansion, and it's completely devoted to the homes, the second homes, the third homes, the happy places of the 0.0001%. The title is only a little bit tongue-in-cheek. And back in 2017, I was writing a profile of a Texas oil and gas billionaire named Russell Gordy, who collects ranches the way other rich men collect art. And we were doing a limited tour of some of his favorites, and his Montana ranch in the Crazy Mountains was the absolute gem of his collection, his favorite ranch. And while we were walking around, taking in the landscape, He happened to mention that the rancher just over his border to the south was planning to lease his land for a wind farm. And his whole face darkened as he described how this was going to kill all the birds he loved to hunt and ruin his views and, you know, bring down his property values. And I asked him, kind of joking, kind of not, well, you know, why don't you buy him out? And he said, I've tried. The man is not interested. He's set on doing that wind farm. And even though this had nothing at all to do with the piece I was there to write, I would find myself thinking about it and wondering, you know, who is this stubborn rancher? And what is it like to say no to someone with so much money and influence? And whatever happened with his wind farm? And, you know, it was just something that from time to time, this question stayed with me. And in 2019, doing a kind of random internet trawl, I read about a lawsuit that was unfolding in the Crazy Mountains involving a wind farm or a proposed wind farm and the very wealthy neighbors of that wind farm who were joining forces to stop it.
This book centers so many of these characters, Russell Gordy, Rick Jarrett, but before we go any further with the characters, with the human characters of this story, for those listeners both here in Montana and elsewhere around the country who listen to The Right Question, those who aren't familiar with the Crazy Mountains, again, in South Central Montana, talk about this landscape and what makes it so ripe for the tension and the tumult, for these really difficult relationships between landowners.
The Crazy Mountains are an island mountain range in South Central Montana, as you pointed out. They rise up from the prairie almost like a mirage. They're not connected to anything around them. That's what an island mountain range is. But in this case, there's something particularly almost magical about the sight of these white and, you know, blue mountains that just kind of come up out of the plains and up into the clouds. And they are surrounded in myth and legend and have always been a sacred landscape for the Crow people, who regarded the Crazies as a kind of fearsome place where, you know, if you really wanted to prove yourself as, say, a young warrior or a leader, you would climb up into the Crazies and you would fast for days on end, going without water as well as food, praying to be visited by a great dream, by a vision. And in fact, the Crow word for the Crazies has the word nightmare in it. So there's something kind of fearsome about this power and this vision. And in fact, there is a real magnetism to these mountains. And people feel very strongly about it. And I came to a true understanding of the depth of this magnetism when I heard the story of the Clovis child. This was a boy who, a little boy, somewhere between the ages of 1 and 2, who lived and died 13,000 years ago. And his people buried him in a cliffside, completely directly facing the Crazy Mountains. And they buried him with a trove of extraordinary tools and stone objects that had taken untold hours to make and which had never been used. They had been created to be buried. And this is the oldest known burial site in the Americas, in North America, South America. It is an extraordinary location. And why did his people bury him there? Why, of all the places in the world, did these people choose this one spot, a hillside where the sun, as it rose over the Crazy Mountains, would hit this place with its rays? And it really sent a shiver down my spine when I stood in that same spot where this child's burial spot had been discovered and looked at those mountains and appreciated that I was seeing the same view that these people must have looked at 13,000 years ago. So yes, so there really is almost a kind of a magnetism, a strange sort of force field around these mountains and this landscape. And it's not surprising to me that people feel as strongly as they do about it.
This Clovis child, just for our listeners' reference, it's believed that, what, 80, 90% of indigenous populations in North America or the Americas can be traced back to this skeleton, to this child, right?
Yes. It makes him even more extraordinary because a paleogeneticist who studied the child and spent years sequencing his DNA told me, if you were ever going to use a word like atom in a scientific context, this child is the Adam of the Americas, because he is a direct ancestor of almost every indigenous person living in North America or South America today. And that is an extraordinary kind of realization.
You write at the end of this chapter that you've written on the Clovis child and the discovery of the Clovis child, that if he is the Adam, then this area, this region of the crazies, the land that sits in the shadow of these mountains, it must be Eden. And that speaks to this magnetism that you're talking about, the grand nature of this place. I do, Amy, want to talk about Crow Agency and the Absalika Nation, but I want to save that until we sort of give our listeners an idea about the dispute at the center of your book. I mean, you give so much page space to the Absalika Nation, and this is a land dispute, so it seems obvious to me that you would include the original stewards of this land.
Yes.
And I do want to talk about them, but let's go back, or I guess in some cases forward, to this proposed wind farm and the people involved in that dispute. So you've already introduced Rick Jarrett, who owned Crazy Mountain Cattle Company.
Yes.
Russell Gordy, this billionaire who created Rock Creek Ranch.
Yeah.
Let's keep going. Introduce the players in this story.
Yes, absolutely. And Rick Jarrett, to give him his full due, was a fifth-generation cattle rancher. His ancestors had homesteaded this land and were among the first white settlers. And he was determined to hang on to this ranch, a ranch which had gotten smaller and smaller with each generation, as these family ranches do. As, you know, siblings have to divvy up land and there's debt and land gets sold off. So he was very preoccupied with how to, first of all, get his ranch out of debt, which almost every working cattle rancher is operating at something of a loss, because cattle ranching just does not pay the bills, and also ensuring that it was going to be there for his grandkids. And so, even though he did not believe in climate change, and was as much of a Fox News viewer as his antagonists, he really wanted to lease his land for wind development, because the royalties that wind energy would have earned for him would have basically ensured the future of his ranch. So he is on one side of this. He is he is team rancher. With him is his neighbor, Alfred Anderson, who is in his late 80s, is the descendant of Norwegian immigrants, and has spent his entire life ranching. It's the only thing he's ever wanted to do. He's not so sure about this windmill thing, but when he realizes that, maybe it will enable him to, build a tool shed for the first time on his ranch, or fix his corrals, or buy a really good bull to improve his calves, his livestock, he decides he's going to give it a try. On the other side, so their neighbors, Rick and Alfred's neighbors, include some of the richest people in America. So in addition to Russell Gordy, we have Whitney McMillan and the McMillan family, who are the heirs to the Cargill agribusiness empire, and they are one of the wealthiest families on the planet. Whitney McMillan has a beautiful mountain ranch where he loves to go fly fishing and lives a very modest lifestyle when he's there, which is about 2 weeks out of the year, maximum. So he too, while he has a distaste for entering into this sort of conflict, he's obsessive about privacy. The whole McMillan family is extremely private. He decides at some point he's going to have to become involved in this because, you know, the stakes are too high for this landscape that he also loves. There are a few more neighbors on their side, but I will mention that the other two are mere millionaires, not billionaires. One of them is a Las Vegas celebrity attorney named David Chesnoff, who is, I guess, Sin City's top litigator, kind of made his chops defending high-profile mobsters and pop stars who got busted in a casino with some cocaine. He has his ranch there as well. So he joins with this collective to stop the wind farm.
You're listening to A Conversation with Amy Gammerman. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Fact and Fiction, an independent bookstore located in the heart of downtown Missoula, Montana. Providing books for all ages and supporting the literary community in Montana and beyond. More information can be found at factandfictionbooks.com. We haven't yet talked about the wind prospector in the book's subtitle. This is Marty Wild. He's this wind farm developer. He's the catalyst, or he's the person who goes to Rick Jarrett and Alfred Anderson with this kernel of an idea. It's their land he wants to lease for this wind farm. Talk about Marty. He's quite the character. I'll leave that to you, actually, Amy. Introduce Marty Wild to our listeners.
I will. So Marty Wild was a wind prospector. And I use the word prospector quite deliberately. He was a modern incarnation of the gold prospectors who flooded into Montana a century or more than a century ago. Except instead of panning for gold, he was seeking his treasure in the air. He was looking for wind. At that time, there were all kinds of valuable federal incentives for wind development. And Marty understood that Montana has some of the best wind. And so he was basically working out of the back of a pickup truck, sniffing out the good wind, hearing what, you know, where the good spots were, setting up his secondhand meteorological equipment. And as it was described to me, these wind prospectors are a very paranoid, cagey bunch. They're all guarding their secret spots from each other. They're stealing spots from each other. And Marty had been sniffing around the crazy mountains for years, hoping to harness the screaming winds that came down off those peaks. And that's how when Marty really loved wind, he'd say it was screaming wind. And this was wind you could take to the bank. So Marty was teamed up with Rick Jarrett. The two of them liked each other instantly, birds of a feather, two single guys of a certain age who behave the way single guys of a certain age, you know, you might think they behave. Mm-hmm. And they teamed up to do this wind project together. It took a while to bring Alfred Anderson into their fold. He was reluctant, but eventually he was persuaded to join them as well. And Marty was a completely rambunctious, pugnacious figure and, you know, never backed down from a fight.
The way that you've characterized the million and billionaires that have purchased acreage in the shadow of the crazies, and in some cases, the peaks themselves, these are men who have made their money often, except for maybe Chesnoff, through oil and gas exploration in other states. And then they came to Montana to build these large vacation homes or ranches. They're here only, you know, 2 weeks out of the year, a month out of the year. You emphasize Russell Gordy's love of the land, or he emphasizes his love to you, his wish to preserve it, his supposed respect for the land, the wildlife, the fish. And yet, I mean, he made his billions exploiting other landscapes by extractive means, right? Within these extractive industries. You introduced Rick Jarrett and sort of dipped into this idea of legacy, I think, why he chooses to do what he does, why he chooses to remain a cattle rancher despite its difficulty. Talk about that word, though, legacy, because it applies to almost everyone in this story. And further, talk about this tension that I did such a poor job of articulating.
These
men who are spouting their love of the landscape, and you know, this is the reason why they don't want Rick Jarrett to build this wind farm, Rick and Alfred and Marty, to build their wind farm. They don't want their landscape, their views obscured.
Yes.
And yet they have no problem, no problem exploiting landscapes elsewhere. Talk about that tension, Amy, and maybe how you saw it existing in the men on both sides of this dispute, how you came to see that tension again on both sides.
Yeah, you're absolutely, you've nailed it, Lauren, because it is all about legacy. And yet what legacy means is so very different. One of the rich ironies of this story, and I have to say one of the things that drew me to it from the beginning, was the spectacle of an oil and gas billionaire draping himself in the mantle of environmental stewardship, you know, to save the crazies, to save this landscape. And the McMillans as well. Cargill is responsible for raising miles and miles of rainforest in Paraguay and other places. It's interesting how selective that that conservation impulse can be. In the case of the wealthy people who own their own chunk of this mountain range, which I think I should point out, this is an important thing for people to know. You can, in fact, own a mountain. I didn't know that you could. It didn't seem kosher to me. Like, you know, it's like owning a bald eagle. Like, can a private person own a mountain? Well, in fact, in Montana and many other places out west, they can, because that land was sold off during the late 19th century as the Transcontinental Railroad was being financed. So they are able to buy their own piece of this mountain range. And yes, the word that would come up when I would be speaking with them was legacy. This land is my legacy. This is my legacy for my children. This is my legacy in a greater sense, because here is this beautiful expanse of pristine land, and I am preserving it. And yes, you could say that is true. But there was a kind of narcissism to it as well. You know, because who are you to see yourself reflected in a mountain range? And I would say that the flip side of the conservation and, you know, my legacy is conserving this, it's also, you could say, a form of curating, because this is their landscape, this is their viewshed, and they have their own ideas about how that should be and what its future should be. So that is their sense of legacy. And for Rick Jarrett, the legacy was also, the sense of legacy was also very real. And it was, I would argue more burdensome in some ways, because when you have received this land, this patch of dirt that you're running your cows on, and you know that generations before you have suffered and bled to keep this land, the prospect of perhaps being the Jarrett who has to sell out is just, you know, that's your nightmare. Like, that's, you don't want to be the descendant who says it was all just too hard and sells out. And And that is, so for them, the legacy, the land owning legacy in the Crazies, it's a great gift, it's a great privilege, but it is also a tremendous burden and source of worry.
Amy, you touched on this idea briefly, I think, but explain how this particular landscape, Big Timber, the Crazies, how this landscape is owned and divided. You mentioned the railroad.
Yes.
Talk about the very complicated, very fascinating checkerboard of public and private land in this region. Talk about why it became that way and the history of, that checkerboard.
Yes, and checkerboard is a word. If you spend any time at all in the Crazies or reading about the Crazies, you hear the word checkerboard. And what that refers to is a checkerboard pattern of public land and private land that looks, in fact, like a chessboard or, you know, where you play checkers. And the reason that that exists is because when Abraham Lincoln, back in the 1860s, decided that a transcontinental railroad was absolutely essential to the future of the nation, and not just to the prosperity of the nation, but in the middle of a civil war, that the Union was going to need a railroad to deliver things like, gold stamping equipment to the gold mines so that they could get the gold to keep financing the war effort. So to finance, to attract investors to build this railroad, the government made a deal, and the deal was, we will give you every other square of land, and you're going to be able to do whatever you want with that land. You're going to be able to lease it if you want to. You can sell it. We will hold every other parcel for the public, and so that is how you have this. This crazy quilt, if you will, of private ranches blocking, in some cases, public lands that are deeper in the mountains or where you can't get to public land because it's so locked off by privately owned squares. And it's an enormous source of frustration for many people in Montana who love the Crazies and would like to hike there and hunt there. You just can't get to them. They are extremely inaccessible, and it kind of adds to the whole mystique about them and to the mirage-like quality, I would argue, because like they're there, but you can't get to them. It's like this vision of something amazing and inaccessible. There are, I think, only two main roads, and they're not even real roads. They're like rutted dirt roads.
This is the first part of a two-part conversation with journalist Amy Gammerman, author of The Crazies, The Cattleman, The Wind Prospector, and A War Out West, out now from Simon & Schuster. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. To listen to this conversation again, to share it with friends, or to learn more about Amy, head to mtpr.org. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.